Dr. Heather Munro-Bloom, Principal of McGill University, Professor Daniel Jutras, Dean of the Faculty of Law, Professor Colleen Shepherd, Director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, Mr. and Mrs. Eckenberg, founders of the conference series, dear invited speakers, dear young leaders, now McGill Eckenberg Human Rights Fellows, ladies and gentlemen. My name is François Crépeau. I'm professor of international law here at McGill, and I'm the chair of this conference. I'll be your MC this evening. It is a pleasure and an honor to welcome you all to Montreal, to McGill, and to this second Eckenberg Family Conference on Human Rights at McGill University, the Global Conference on Human Rights and Diverse Societies. It is an amazing opportunity to chair a conference of such magnitude on such an important topic with such a distinguished list of panelists and with such an inspiring group of young leaders. You have to understand, for those who don't know about the young leaders, that 25 young leaders from all over the world, that is 23 countries on 5 continents, having studied in almost as many disciplines, with extraordinary work and volunteer experiences, have come together and worked hard since Monday to prepare for us a statement on the issue of human rights and diverse societies, a statement that will be presented at the closing plenary of this conference. The conference provides us with a remarkable opportunity to reflect on a theme which is pressing all over the world. It is timely and essential in Quebec, in Canada, as in all countries, but it is also a key to global peace and to the harmonious development of our planet. Human diversity is a fact that has often been denied because of religious, nationalist, socialist, or other hegemonic ideologies. It is and will remain a challenge, because to most of us, whatever is unknown is always somehow felt and represented as a threat. We are not naturally immune from the influence of hate speech. We often react gregariously, attaching collective tags to individual identities. We too quickly resort to the us and them mentality, reducing the individual to a stereotype, negating the complexities of each human life, essentializing one characteristic among many others, and therefore actually dehumanizing the person. Defying the prejudgments and reaching out to those who are despised, marginalized, or persecuted is the essence of ethical behavior, and it is the foundation for all human rights work. Nelson Mandela famously said, "For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others." End of quote. Measured on this scale, we are not free societies, or not yet completely free societies. And it is to reflect on the ways to change our collective and individual behavior in favor of a better recognition of diversity as an asset, as inherent to the dignity of our species, that we are gathered here for 3 days. I would like to thank, many people have to be thanked, and this will be done, but I would like personally to thank the executive director of the center, Dr. Nandini Ramanujam, and her team, her excellent team, with whom I've had the privilege of working for the past several months, for making this conference a concrete reality. They have put their imagination, their energy, and countless hours into preparing this extraordinary meeting. I shall now ask Dr. Heather Munro-Bloom, Principal of McGill University, to welcome you.
Merci, Professor Crépeau, et bonsoir, bienvenue tout le monde. C'est vraiment un plaisir pour moi, une source de fierté pour moi d'être ici ce soir pour le commencement de cet événement si spécial mais si important. I want to, Professor Crapo, thank you for taking on the chair of this conference, to thank the colleagues who work so diligently in the center and for their leadership, to welcome our distinguished panelists this evening. It is a great pleasure to have you here at McGill and for this conference. And I want to make a special word of thank you to Dean Daniel Jutra for the leadership that he's bringing to the faculty, the emphasis that he's putting on this important field, but also the interaction of human rights with so many other elements of the law and the law from a global perspective. But I want to mention in a very special way Gord and Penny Eckenberg, and to thank them and their family for the commitment that they've made to having the Eckenberg Family Conference in Human Rights at McGill every year. And Gord, I know that this has been a vision of yours that's been expressed in different ways throughout your lifetime, and we share in the enormous sense of comfort and gratification that we can bring our great young leaders together, our distinguished panelists, and a wonderful community of participants to every year at a minimum have a broad reflection on this key theme of importance. And as we do think about human rights and diverse societies, it is absolutely true, without saying it, but I will, that whatever we may have felt about the need to engage at the personal level, at the scholarly level, at the level of public policy, at the legal level, simply as communities, with human rights considerations, thinking, of course, about our own community, the world is simply so mobile on every element of what we think of as healthy civil society, the way health status is expressed, not in a local way anymore, but travels around the world, the impact of economy, not just on a local community, but around the world, the very sense of what it means to be safe and secure in our communities simply cannot be separated from safety and security of all of us as citizens of the world. And so I can't think of a more timely moment to come together on this particular theme. And again, I thank the organizers, the panelists, all of you for being here, and to our young leaders, no pressure, but we have great hopes and expectations about the leadership that you'll bring over time to this important theme. Merci encore pour être avec nous ce soir pour cette conférence et dans les plusieurs jours. I wish you a wonderful conference, deep engagement, and a lot of satisfaction. And as with any forum like this, it should be a place for a free and open exchange of ideas. Diversity will be the key intellectually as well as in the various methodologies that we talk about for advancing human rights on the world stage. And I will finish simply saying that, of course, the work starts when the conference stops. Merci beaucoup et bonsoir.
I will now invite Professor Daniel Jutra, Dean of the Faculty of Law, to say a few words.
Merci, François. Good evening, everyone. An opening ceremony like this is obviously an occasion to express gratitude, and you will hear lots of thank yous tonight. And I wish to begin by expressing mine very briefly, and I hope yours by the same token. There are many people to thank, but I will single out only a few. So thank you, Principal Monroe Bloom, for being here, taking the time to join us and lending your support to this event, and encouraging me and encouraging the entire Faculty of Law to reach beyond itself on every occasion and every opportunity. I also want to thank François Crépeau and Nandini Ramanujam for structuring and giving shape to this extraordinary space for dialogue that you will all enjoy over the next few days. And then finally, thank you to Gordon and Penny Eckenberg for their vision of what can be accomplished when the university joins the community and turns ideas into real life. and for providing the financial means to bring this vision to life. Very important support to this faculty, for which we're all very grateful. Now, let's be frank, an opening ceremony like this one is often devoid of any sense of excitement. Thank yous are acknowledged as par for the course, and it's a passage obligé, as we'd say in French. Everybody has to go through this before one gets to bite into the real substance of the conference, and you'll get some real substance tonight. But I would say that tonight is not the usual opening ceremony, and there, as I look across the room, there are no jaded faces in this amphitheater. I look across the room, and I see the beautiful faces of my students and of the young leaders who are gathered here tonight, and of young men and women coming from across the campus, across the city, and indeed across the world, full of hope and full of purpose. And I look across the room and I see, I would say, more or less wrinkled faces of my colleagues and distinguished guests and invited speakers and alumni and friends of this great university, and they're full of wisdom and they're equally full of purpose. The energy and dedication and aspirations of the people in this room make this second Ekenberg Family Global Conference on Human Rights a unique, wonderful gathering. We've had a sense of that already over the past few days with the gathering of the young leaders. I want each and everyone to thank each and every one of you for being here and for carrying into the deliberations that will take place over the next few days the energy and excitement that we can feel tonight as we approach the conference itself. Les prochains jours seront remplis de débats sur la diversité et la tolérance, et je voudrais offrir à tous ceux et celles qui ont rendu possible cet événement, organisateurs, bénévoles, donateurs, conférenciers et participants, bien entendu, un très beau texte, une portion d'un très beau texte sur l'acceptation de l'autre, autrefois chanté par Pauline Julien. It's a song, but I won't sing it. The song is a plea for tolerance and acceptance and peace. In English, it could be titled, Take Me As I Am. And in French, it's entitled, Comme je crie, comme je chante. Now, I know that many of you in the room don't understand French, but I think you will hear, I hope you will hear, the force and the music of this beautiful poem. Prenez-moi comme je suis, sans médaille ni diplôme, un homme parmi d'autres, l'œil hagard, l'air inquiet, prenez-moi comme je suis. Impossible de faire mieux, car on est comme on peut. We are as we can. Prenez-moi comme je crie, car je crois que je chante. La façon la plus sûre est de bien faire connaissance et de jouer à 2, à 10, à 100, à 1000, afin de découvrir ce qui va de travers dans nos petits enfers. L'amour a des idées qui lancent les nations vers la libération. Le soleil nous attend depuis notre naissance. Il a fait noir longtemps, mais la vie recommence à choyer le présent. Oui, nous les briserons les chaînes du passé. Je vous raconterai ce qu'il faudrait d'oubli pour construire un silence à la mesure des nuits. Prenez-moi comme ceci, comme cela, comme je sais. Prenez-moi comme je crie, même si moi je vous dis que je crois que je chante. Long live the Ekenberg Family Global Conference on Human Rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Jutras. I think I can say that we'll post the poem on the website of the conference, and we'll probably ask a student to make a translation for all of you to be able to enjoy the text of that poem. I will now ask Professor Colleen Shepherd, Director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, to say a few words.
Merci, François. Mesdames et messieurs, au nom du Centre sur les droits de la personne et le pluralisme juridique, c'est un grand honneur de vous accueillir à McGill et à Montréal. On behalf of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, it is a great honor to welcome you to the Global Conference on Human Rights and Diverse Societies. Having just assumed the directorship of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism after a year on sabbatical, I'm in the position of joining the conference initiative after all of the hard work has been done. And for their tremendous intellectual and logistical work, therefore, I wish to thank my colleagues, Professor François Crépeau, academic director of the conference, for bringing his knowledge and insights to the framing of the conference themes, and to Dr. Anandini Ramanujam, the Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, whose energy and creative organizational magic has made this conference happen. My thanks as well to the committed and diligent work of the administrative staff and the law at the law faculty and the team of law student conference coordinators and organizers. Merci aussi à notre doyen, Dean Daniel Jutra, for his steadfast support in encouraging our work in this area and ensuring the success of the conference. I also wish to add my voice to the chorus of thank yous to Penny and Gordon Eckenberg for committing resources to make possible the nurturing of a public space for engaging with the complex issues of diversity and human rights, and for their commitment to ensuring that we build a global community of young leaders. Your generosity is deeply appreciated, and your engagement infectious. Merci beaucoup. We're also deeply appreciative of the support from all of our sponsors, including the Government of Quebec. The theme for this conference, Human Rights and Diverse Societies, is complex, multifaceted, and interdisciplinary. It touches upon issues of equality, group-based identities, and social inclusion and exclusion. It resonates in important ways with the raison d'être of our center, which is concerned with the ways in which the universal language of human rights operates within a plurality of legal orders, both formal and informal. And the conference addresses an issue of global importance, how to relate across our differences with respect, dignity, and equality. I'm very much looking forward to the sharing of ideas and debates over the next few days. Thank you all for being here. Merci beaucoup.
Mr. and Mrs. Eckenberg's vision are the inspiration for this conference, behind this conference. And I would like to invite Gordon Eckenberg to say a few words.
Thank you, François. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And a special thank you and welcome to our 35 panelists and our 25 young leaders from 23 countries. I will save time by simply echoing my thanks to everybody who has been thanked. I can assure you they deserve it. It is the hope of Penny and I that this series of conferences and young leaders' forums will have some practical contribution to make to the advancement of human rights and the spread of human dignity. We're fully cognizant that such a contribution may, in fact, in the end, almost be minimal. We are equally aware that it won't be transformative. However, if we only become better informed about human rights and, as a consequence, more prepared to protect and advance them, the cause of human rights will be well served, because it will give us an understanding of their importance in our universal welfare. If that is accomplished, we will be satisfied. We are also strongly of the view that with rights come obligations, privileges, and responsibilities. We Canadians are indeed privileged living as we do in a Western, secular, democratic, and wealthy society, where domestically our human rights are protected by the Charter of Rights, and where our culture, tradition, and history are living expressions of the benefit of such rights. And those rights and that privilege places obligations and responsibilities on us, and we should never take those for granted. The topic of this conference addresses a central question: can human rights be universal? Or rephrased, can human rights truly have universal application, or must they be defined and limited, inter alia, by tradition, culture, religion, history, politics, and forms of government? Or even in more simple terms, are human rights in a real and practical sense affected and indeed ultimately controlled, manipulated, used, and abused by the reality in which they are exercised? Have human rights become a password simply for foreign policy of some and convenience to be exploited by others? The very nature of the topic demands a review of the differences that permeate our world and affect our very different thinking on the subject. We who live in the democratic, highly developed, multicultural societies, and especially places like Canada, sometimes appear to be hibernating in a protected bubble of freedom and security. We occupy a unique position in the history of man. In many ways, we are the beneficiary of the earliest expressions and demands for human rights. But we are also the actors in recent times who promoted their development and expansion. In today's world, however, we risk diluting human rights agenda by labeling almost everything a human right. In our democratic Western societies, we seem more ready to indulge in the benefits we claim can be derived from human rights. But as a result, we sometimes tend to pontificate on and about global human rights. Those in less developed and poorer nations of the world, many living in poverty and are under tyrannical government authority, may have very different concepts of human rights. For many of them, the basic right to shelter and food predominate. Debating the esoteric aspects of rights becomes secondary. Trying to impose what we may see as our value system on their way of life will be resisted and frequently resented. Those who come from homogeneous societies or religiously denominated ones equally have a different point of departure. A country or a people's history and the development, to say nothing of the culture, religion, and tradition, will in all likelihood affect their definition of what constitutes a human right, as well as the latitude for its expansion. The politics and importance of numbers cannot be minimized in any discussion or debate. For example, India and China represent approximately one half of the world's population. Their histories are long. They both internalize great diversity. No country in the world is internally more diverse than India, who also has a long and often tortured history. But today is a democracy as compared to, say, China, a communist-controlled dictatorship with a modern-day history of human rights abuses, at least by our standards. On the other hand, China has, in a matter of a few decades, become the second largest economy in the world. The whole underlying economic system in China has been transformed. This will no doubt result, and indeed has already resulted, in political transformation and human rights demands. In terms of religion, the Christian world accounts for approximately a quarter of the people in the world. Their beliefs and history, as well as the influence of the countries which they populate, particularly those Western democratic developed societies, and especially the United States, equally reflect points of departure that will differ from, say, the Islamic world. Numbers count. And the Islamic world, with between 1.5 and 2 billion people, with both an evangelical and a radicalized fundamental militant side, raises other issues. Even the world's tiny Jewish population has a prominent in the place of human rights history, in part because of its historic recognition by the Christian and Islamic faith, but also partly because it forms part of the Judeo-Christian ethic and the morality which underpins Western societies. Buddhism and other Eastern faiths have a different effect on rights agendas in their societies. If religion has an effect, then what about the lack of religion? How does the agnostic and the atheist visualize human rights? All these influences in turn play out in other societies, cultures, and countries of the world as the search for human rights becomes the common thread found among all diversities. In this ever-shrinking, more technically oriented and volatile world, the spread of human rights remains our best hope in search of universal human dignity. To simply point ourselves in the right direction will demand organizational skills as well as a concerted societal and governmental effort. This will not be easily accomplished. This conference represents a speck of sand on the beach of need. Differences exist, and harsh decisions cannot be avoided. It is not wrong, improper, immoral, or even politically incorrect to make judgments. They must, however, be appropriate and even empathetic. Too often such judgments are made in the belief that those decisions can be evangelically exported to other societies. They can't be. Changes take time, and change is more often accomplished with understanding and out of respect for the other than out of ignorance and a lack of understanding of that other. Change takes time and requires leadership. Where leadership is lacking, it's doubtful that successful change can occur. So that brings me to the other part of the conference, the Young Leaders Forum. It is these young leaders from around the world who may well be the true legacy of this conference series. They are now 59 leaders from 41 countries. I can assure you that they are inspiring. The 24 from this year have just finished 4 days of meetings, with five from our first conference in 2007. I urge you to seek them out over the next 2 days. Engage them. Our future and that of our children may rest in the hands of their generation, with the beliefs that they have and their understanding of leadership. If they are the example of leadership that we can expect, then in the case of human rights, a future for human rights, a future for these conferences, and Penny and I will be satisfied with your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Gordon, for the inspiring vision that you have so eloquently articulated. We now must plunge into the substance of this conference, and I will invite the chair and the speakers of our first panel to come on stage. The chair will be my colleague and former professor, Erwin Kotler, who is Member of Parliament in Ottawa, former Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada. The speakers will be Ms. Malalai Joya, the Right Honourable Dennis McShane, Commissioner Faith Pensit-Lakula, and Commissioner Mary Wilson.
May I join the words of appreciation that have been expressed, and I want to not only share them but reinforce them and express my appreciation to the faculty of Law at McGill, which I always say has been and remains my home. And when Francois referred to the days when he was my student, I have to say the days when I was a teacher were always regarded by me as my best days. I don't want to say that the best days are behind me, but I have a particular feel and almost love for the university, for academe, and so express my appreciation for McGill, its exemplary faculty and students, for the organizers of this conference, for les conférenciers qui viennent de tout le monde, for the young leaders who have come to inspire us here. We're all delighted to be part of this collective ambiance. Et je voudrais souhaiter une chaleureuse bienvenue, a really warm welcome to this opening plenary on human rights and social diversity, which seeks to address some of the compelling themes that will find expression in the next several days. The question of the universalization of human rights in an age of diversity, of identity in an age of globalization, of the relationship between security and rights, of freedom of expression and hate speech, or the phenomenon of the demonization of the other, things that will be discussed and the role of the media in this rayonnement of these issues. And we in this panel have been invited to share some personal reflections on the question of human rights and social diversity. As Professor Francois Crépeau wrote us, this theme of human rights and social diversity is not just, as he put it, a matter of intellectual pyrotechnics. It is something that impacts deeply and profoundly on all of us. It can impact on us in a way that pains us and may even scar us in some of our encounters with respect to issues of human rights, identity, and diversity. And it can impact on us in ways that inspire us and can have even a transformative impact on us, both individually and collectively. Fortunately, we have a wonderful panel to deal with these issues, whom I will introduce appropriately in turn, but they represent in and of themselves the very diversity of which this conference speaks of and which we trust will resonate throughout the conference in its teachings. And may I begin by sharing with you two vignettes out of my own experience, this being my own, you know, personal reflections on the issues of human rights and social diversity. The first is anchored in teachings of my family, because one goes back to where are those first early influences in formation in terms of identity, in terms of developing one's world's view of human rights and social diversity. And the second deals with McGill Law School and the advent of the constitutional revolution and developments in that regard. Let me begin, first of all, with the personal and family vignette. When I was growing up, my parents would teach me about the importance of the pursuit of justice in a way that was, at the time, more profound than I was capable of appreciating it then. But that notion of pursuing justice remained with me and became a kind of composite of a personal and professional identity. It became the looking glass through which I not only viewed the world, but the looking glass through which I related and became involved in the world. And my father, as I said, taught me before I could understand the profundity of the message, you know, that kind of biblical injunction, and taught it to me in four languages of justice, justice shall you pursue, in terms of appreciating the universality of the message by learning it in four languages, and saying to me that this was equal to all the other commandments combined, that this was something that should be taught from generation to generation, that this was not only an individual ethic but a collective responsibility. But I have to say that it was my mother's comment on this teaching that may have had a more profound influence, though it could not have existed without the original teaching itself. My mother would say to me that if you want to pursue justice, then you have to understand, you have to feel the sense of injustice about you. Otherwise, the pursuit of injustice is an abstract notion. Otherwise, it's a theoretical construct. As she said, you have to go in and about the community, sur le terrain, as we say, in order to sense the feel and to be able to act on that injustice. And so it was, and fast forward, and you'll see the connecting links, that when I was sworn in as Minister of Justice many, many years later, the first words I uttered when we had and we were brought out into the kind of collective scrum after we were sworn in, the first words that I uttered was that I will be guided in my work, and was almost as if my parents were speaking through me, that I will be guided in my work by that overarching principle of justice, justice shall you pursue. And within that, the promotion and protection of equality not just as a provision in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms or other rights covenants, but equality as an organizing principle for the building of a just society. And the promotion and protection of human dignity for the building of a society that was not only just, but one that would be compassionate and humane. And so, with this approach, I said to myself, I should go about my mother's words resonating in my mind, go about the country, go into the trenches, and see and try to feel the injustice, because I was recalling another teaching brought about by our professor at McGill Law School, and Dean and Gordy and I studied Professor Frank Scott, said that the test of a just society is how does it treat the most vulnerable amongst it. So to go about and see what was happening, what was the state, the condition of the vulnerable peoples. But as it happened, before I could go in and about Sur le Terrain in the trenches, I was told that a group of law students, of Aboriginal law students, from a Kitsurak law school in Nunavut, had come to Ottawa and would I meet with them. This became my first encounter after becoming Minister of Justice. It's this encounter that I want to share with you, because it framed not only the narrative with regard to Aboriginal justice, but I would say almost the approach to the protection of vulnerable groups. When I met with them, the students said, Professor Collett, we're not just law students. We're Aboriginal law students. We come with a past, with a history, with a heritage, with a culture, with an identity, with our languages, our religion, with our own indigenous legal tradition. And we've been dispossessed from all that. We've been dislocated from our land, from our history, from our heritage, from our culture, from our language, from our identity, and our religion. And it's not that we go to court because we want to nurture a grievance. But we go to court to reaffirm who we are. We go to court to nurture our roots. We go to court to give expression to our own indigenous legal tradition. But tragically, in whatever we do, we are always accompanied by a great deal of pain, because we feel that the Canadian government and the Canadian people don't understand who we are and what we aspire to be. And so I said to them at that point that I would share with them a parable which comes out of my tradition but could be found in other traditions as well. And the parable is where students come to their rabbi and they say, Rabbi, we love you. And the rabbi says, do you know what hurts me? And the students say, Rabbi, why do you ask if we know what hurts you? If we tell you, we love you. And the rabbi answers, because if you don't know what hurts me, you can't tell me you love me. If you think about it, it's a profound principle for human relationships. It's an application of what referred to Mandela about preserving and protecting and bringing about the freedom for others. And as I said to them, we will seek to be guided as a government in our relationships with you by that principle. We may not fully understand and cannot certainly fully feel the pain, but we will act in a manner in which we will try to understand what is it that we can do as a government with respect to the alleviation of pain and the fulfillment of your own aspirations. And so we developed, with this I close, a framework of the 7 R's. We made the question of Aboriginal justice a priority on the justice agenda. We said that in the end of the day, this is how we expect to be judged as a government. And the 7 R's were, 1, respect for the Aboriginal people as the original inhabitants in this country. 2, recognition of the distinguishable legal and constitutional identity of the Aboriginal peoples as consecrated, among others, in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. 3, the 3rd R, redress for past wrongs, whether it be the abuses wrought by the residential schools, which Phil Fontaine said was one of the most racist act ever committed in Canada. 4, the phenomenon of the 4th R, the double entendre of representation. In other words, the over-representation of Aboriginal peoples in the criminal justice system, inmates and the like, and the under-representation of Aboriginal people as justice, as law enforcement officers, and the like. The 5th R was responsiveness.
The government had to be responsive and legally responsive. For example, when it engaged in resource development with respect to indigenous needs and titles before it proceeded. And the courts, in fact, then enshrined this. Number six was, if you do the first 5 hours, if you do respect and recognition and redress and representation and responsiveness, you will get to the sixth R, which will be reconciliation, and that can take you to the seventh R, which would be renewal. And we sought to, as I say, in terms of framing human rights and diversity, be guided by that inspiration. I think I've taken sufficient time on that first vignette, so I will not go into the second. If time permits in discussion or people ask about it, I will. It had to do, just mention it, with the battle over same-sex marriage in this country. One of the most compelling constitutional, legal, parliamentary, political, generational, familial struggles that took place. And that brings the whole question of human rights and diversity into its multifaceted focus. If time subsequently permits, I'll try and share that with you. Thank you. Let me begin now in terms of our panelists, and in the order in which you find them in your program, we'll begin with Malala Joyaud, who's not only the youngest member of parliament in Afghanistan, but has been referred to as the most courageous parliamentarian in Afghanistan, indeed one of the most courageous women in the world today. Time magazine, not that I usually quote Time magazine, but on this I will, in 2010 characterized her as one of the most 100 most influential and important people in the world. But I think the real importance lies and has found expression in the incredible courage and resilience and commitment of this wonderful young woman.
Good evening, everyone. Very nice to meet you all. First of all, I extend my deep regards and thanks to friends and supporters in the McGill University who invited me here as a representative of suffering Afghan women to share with you the awful problems and tragedies that we are facing under the US and NATO, including Canadian occupation and the brutalities of the Islamic fundamentalists. I was on a speaking tour to Canada around 1 year ago. I talked about the ongoing tragedy of Afghanistan and the game of the U.S. and its allies play with the destiny of my suffering nation. After 1 year, I'm sorry that I don't have anything positive and hopeful about Afghanistan to present to you. Unfortunately, what I had predicted seems to be realized with a deeper disaster today, and the conditions of Afghanistan go from worse to worse. The reason of the catastrophic situation of Afghanistan is the wrong policy of US and NATO, including Canada government, because after 9/11 tragedy, they pushed us from the frying pan into the fire, as they replaced Taliban, these terrorist groups, with the fundamentalists, warlords who are mentally same like Taliban, but only physically has been changed. And they has been imposed on my people. Those who have bloody hands and committed many crimes against women rights, human rights, before of the domination of the Taliban from 92 to 96 when they were in power. But when Obama took office, unfortunately, his first news for my people was more conflict, more war. Because his foreign policy is quite similar, like criminal Bush. He surged more troops in Afghanistan, which will bring more conflict and more war. He is ready to negotiate with terrorist persons like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who his name was in the blacklist of the U.S., and also Mullah Omar, this terrorist man. And also he is expanding war in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Yemen. At least these are briefly what I said, that these are the reasons that our people believe that he is a second and more dangerous Bush for our country. To tell you better, just he is a warmonger. And also he safeguards the corporate interest in the meantime. And maybe you heard about the initial promises of the withdrawal of the troops in 2011. It's clear that they will not be leaving anytime soon and just want to deceive the U.S. people, first of all, Democrat people around the world, by making such lies. The U.S. and its allies occupied my country under the name of war on terror, but today they themselves are terrorizing Afghan people and have deep hidden deals with terrorist groups. The war on terror is just a show, while in fact they have pushed Afghanistan and the whole region into a haven for terrorists. Taliban and other terrorist groups were not that powerful in 2001. Today, besides such groups, Afghanistan has been changed into a capital of drug mafia, and the U.S. and allies indirectly back them and still support them. The puppet regime of Hamid Karzai, which is full of these worst enemies of my people who involved in war crimes, lootings, drug dealings, and corruption. Billions of dollars of aid have been donated to Afghanistan during this 9 years. But most of this money has been looted by these warlord strugglers. And also, even the internal income of the country is being looted by a handful of enemies of our people. Therefore, the gap between rich and poor, day by day, getting wider and wider. In the so-called liberated Afghanistan, the situation of my people is tragic more than ever. Women's rights situation is as catastrophic as it was under the domination of the Taliban. Rape cases, kidnappings, acid attacks, domestic violences, poison the girls' schools, and many other crimes increasing rapidly, even historical. But the only difference with Taliban period is that all of these crimes are happening under the name of democracy. Tens of women every day commit suicide as only way to escape their miseries and destitution. In Human Development Index, Afghanistan is ranked 181st out of 182 countries. According to UNICEF, Afghanistan is the worst place to born, with 257 deaths per 100 life births. In the Corruption Index, Afghanistan is the second most corrupt country in the world. Afghanistan is top producer of opium in the world, and since 2001, the production of opium increased over 4,400%, with 93% of world opium being produced under the very nose of the tens of thousands of U.S. and NATO troops. These are just few examples to show the kind of freedom and democracy they have imposed on Afghanistan. We Afghans can't expect freedom to be donated to us by U.S., which itself is the biggest terrorist country in the world and have imposed war, destruction, and mass killings in countless countries since Second World War. Afghanistan and Iraq are just two of the most current examples. A glance to the history of the U.S. government involvement in different poor countries in the past shows that this country has only overthrown democracies and supported dictators and oppressors. The U.S. and its allies are after their own strategic, economic, and geopolitical interest in my country and want to change Afghanistan into their military bases in the Asia, for which they are playing with the destiny of my suffering people and put them in more dangers. But they hide their evil plans under the nice banners of democracy, human rights, etc., to deceive the world. The donated democracy imposed to Afghanistan is another shameful joke with our people. Fascism and dictatorship is sold under the name of democracy to our people. Let me give you the example of this parliamentary election has been passed in Afghanistan. No question, election is a main sign of democracy, but in our country, now it become a toll in the hand of the puppet regime of Hamid Karzai, and their foreign master to give legitimacy to their regime, this mafia corrupt regime. Election under the shadow of gun, warlordism, draglordism, awful corruption in occupation forces has no legitimacy at all. As a famous saying, it's not important who is voting, it's important who is counting. That's the problem of our people. All the boxes in the hands of these corrupt mafia people who are in power, as they wish, they count the vote of the people, and they betrayed the vote and wish of our people in the past, and will betray more. The head of the election commission is a famous warlord man like Fazl Ahmad Manevi. And these warlords, this 9 years, they become more powerful and they control Afghanistan while, again, they are running in this election. They must go to the National International Criminal Court and instead running for the election. People want to show their hatred to them. They threw red color on their picture. It means that they have bloody hands. The U.S. and its allies are making jokes with the name of democracy, which will give a very bad impression of to Afghans regarding democracy and its need. In the past 9 years, Afghan people have been badly betrayed. They are being killed by both the Taliban and warlords on the ground, by occupation forces from the sky. Tens of thousands of innocent civilians have been killed during these 9 years. Many of the massive bombs that they use in Afghanistan, that they dropped on our civilians, are produced in Canada. Their use may fill the pockets of the Canadian capitalists with dollars, but on the ground, kill countless innocent Afghans on a daily basis. I think justice-loving people of Canada agree with us that democracy never comes by barrel of gun, by cluster bomb, by white phosphorus. Democracy never came by occupation, by sworn enemies of these values. Dear friends, the U.S. and NATO have hidden contacts and dealings with the terrorist groups and the Taliban, and even they are trying to bring Taliban back in power. While this 9 years, directly and indirectly, they supported Taliban. Maybe you hear that yesterday, even Washington Post gave report that they have secret contact with Taliban. Informally, they invite these terrorists, these dinosaurs, to join this government. Just they want to make complete the circle of warlordism, draglordism, terrorism in Afghanistan. And the victim will be, again, the innocent people of Afghanistan, especially women. U.S. and its allies, they don't want to defeat the Taliban. They don't want to make powerless Taliban because as they make the situation in danger, and it will be a very good excuse for U.S. and its allies to justify their occupation, their war crime in my country. And they want to expand their military bases there. When Afghanistan to be under their control, they can very easily control other Asian countries like Iran, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, etc., and very easily will have access to the gas and oil of the Central Asian republics. And no one can believe that a superpower with a massive military machine and most advanced weaponry is really unable to defeat a small, medieval, and ignorant band such as the Taliban. I will never be tired to say from every audience that no nation can donate liberation to another nation. This is the responsibility of our own people to bring democracy, women rights, human rights. Only those nations who liberate themselves can be free. And we Afghans are ready for any kind of sacrifices for a long and hard struggle against our enemies and secure our freedom. So we Afghans ask for withdrawal of all foreign troops from Afghanistan as they are making things more complicated for our people. The foreign forces present in Afghanistan or not for the benefit of Afghan people. So this is the main reason that we want the withdrawal of these troops as soon as possible, as they are making our fight for justice much harder by empowering reactionary, brutal, and dark-minded forces. All of them, including Canadian forces, directly support these Afghan warlords who have history full of treason and crimes against our people. Right now, there are two kinds of resistance among Afghan people. One is the resistance of ordinary Afghan people. Democrat people of Afghanistan, anti-war intellectuals and groups in Afghanistan. Another is reactionary resistance of the Taliban that always mainstream media try to make big this reactionary resistance. There's a proverb that which suits this policy of the U.S. that making an atom bomb out of an onion. And these Taliban, right now, our people hate them, but they misuse from this opportunity and continue to their fascism. Regarding the report of Professor Mark Herold, as he did research, this Democrat American man, that right now Taliban control over 80% of Afghanistan. We are happy that when the Western government bombards, but the great and peace-loving people of these countries, they stand in solidarity with us and raise their voice against the wrongdoing of their government. We are very impressed by the anti-war movement around the world. Your solidarity and support gives us more courage, more determination, more hopes that to continue to our struggle against injustice, for democracy, for peace and stability in our country. Please carry on your glorious anti-war actions. Progressive and justice-loving elements of Afghanistan, they need your support and helping hand. They need your honest helping hand. So, unlike your government, you should support democratic-minded forces of Afghanistan who are a real alternative for a positive change in my country. So now my message to you is that we need educational support, as education is a key toward emancipation. Heartfelt thanks once again for your solidarity and support.
Thank you, Ms. Joy, and your concluding words, I'm sure, will be felt by all about education being the key to emancipation. I just want to mention that after the four panelists have all spoken, we will open it up for questions. So keep those questions in mind, and we'll be able to pose those questions at the conclusion of the four panelists. It's my pleasure now to invite Dennis McShane, a Member of Parliament from the United Kingdom, a former minister to the European Parliament, a former trade unionist, a journalist, an academic, all in one. And I'm delighted to invite Dennis McShane to share his words with you. Dennis?
Well, thank you, Erwin. There's a bit too much of the former in all of that, I thought. But after that very passionate message from Ms. Joy from Afghanistan, I feel rather humbled. I remember I was very keen for the Soviet Union to quit Afghanistan, which it did in 1987, but something happened in the next 10, 13 years that wasn't quite right. And this does strike me as going to the heart of part of what we're discussing, that the notion you can prescribe human rights from outside is not necessarily the case. There need to be deeper structures of education, of law, of religion, not dictating to the state. And in too many parts of the world, we haven't got that. When Paris was liberated in 1944, General de Gaulle said, I'll put it in English because I think it's mainly an English listening audience, from one day to the next, the people of Paris could say what they liked, go where they liked, meet who they liked. And that, for me, is always with the general's phraseology, which is much tighter in French, almost like François Crépeau's poem, encapsulates, I think, the core of human rights, being able to say and write what you like, meet and organize as you wish, and go where you want to go without let or hindrance. And much of the rest, it seems, are add-ons. I have come from Strasbourg,
where I was earlier this week as a UK delegate to the Council of Europe. And there's the celebration of the 60th anniversary of the adoption of the European Convention on Human Rights, but far more important, the creation of the European Court of Human Rights. Because the United Nations adopted its Convention of Human Rights in 1948, but was unable to have any effective mechanism of enforcement. Whereas what the Europeans did, when I read those rights, I think of 1948, 49, 50, Britain was still an imperial and colonial power, France was still trying to stay in Vietnam, let alone Algeria and other countries, Portugal was a fascist dictatorship, Germany was broken and people were suspicious of it. And there is not just a list of fundamental rights, but the willingness of these powerful states, UN Security Council members, to submit their governments to an external court. And that is why human rights and enforceability, or justiciability, are so, so essential. And I think of that power of law, because I was talking to Pansy, who's going to speak to us from South Africa shortly. I was heavily involved in the 1980s with the Black Independent Trade Union movement in South Africa. And the guys there seized on an extraordinarily powerful weapon. They used what law they had, and South Africa, even as an apartheid state, had some separation, had independent judges. And I spent some time lying in ditches in Alexandra, watching hippos roll by and helping trade unions in strikes, but also time in getting distinguished British lawyers, QCs, to go down and represent people like Moses Mayakiza and black trade union leaders at the time. And it was just possible to create some space. And I'd worked earlier in Poland, where I'd been put in prison by the communist authorities, supporting Solidarność earlier on. And there, too, what the guys did in the and women did in the 1970s with the creation of the Committee of Workers' Rights was to say, we demand the enforcement of the Polish constitution. We're not going to go head into the streets. We're not going to throw bombs. We're not going to shoot anybody. We just want our own constitution to be obeyed. And that just created small areas of space. And there are wonderfully brave Chinese lawyers also insisting in China that Chinese law should be obeyed. So human rights and law come together. The UN, though, unfortunately, is neither a lawgiver nor a law upholder. It's a political construct. It's five permanent members with their vetoes take those vetoes decisions entirely on the basis of their political vision of the world. The United States vetoes, China vetoes, Russia vetoes. I think France and Britain don't much veto. But those are political constructs. So I remember in the 1970s being very involved with people coming out of Argentina after the junta took over in 1976. And there was this great campaign to make the problem of disappeared people into a major human rights issue. And a long campaign to get the UN finally to set up a panel of inquiry into disappeared people. And it was set up, and they appointed an Iraqi to chair it. The only difficulty was that within 1 year he had been disappeared under Saddam Hussein. And this is, it seems to me, one of the great problems on human rights, and that is enforcement. My friend Bernard Kouchner has written his letter of resignation as France's foreign minister to President Sarkozy, and he said very sadly last year that you cannot be in government and fight for human rights. The two are incompatible, because the nature of what the state needs to do cannot coexist with fighting and combating human rights internationally that easily. And I have to report to you that in the new European Union External Action Service, the general view is that human rights is being downgraded. Trade is far more important. We have Mr. Bashir of Sudan, who is indicted in front of the International Criminal Court. And yet the British government is insisting that we must increase trade with Sudan and is rolling out the red carpet for his ministers. I don't know quite how one works out all these contradictions. I do worry because Bernard, in a sense, gave rise to the concept of the droit d'ingérence, the right to intervene, the right to interfere. And he wrote about that, and it arose out of that great concern 20 years ago that we were walking by on the other side of the street as genocide was taking place in Rwanda. And that's something, as we know, very, very sensitive to Canada. Walking by on the other side of the street, I was in the British House of Commons when the then Conservative British Foreign Secretary made a statement about Srebrenica. Srebrenica, where 8,000 men were taken out in a small community in the back of nowhere in the Balkans, stripped, naked, and shot, bang, 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 one after the other. Far worse than any individual Nazi atrocity like Lidice or Oradour-sur-Glan, which people know about, where only hundreds were killed. I'm not talking about the Holocaust or even the communist murder of the Polish intelligentsia and officers at Katyn. But in Europe, in 1995, 8,000 Europeans were taken out and executed one by one. And we didn't know how to interfere. We were frightened to interfere. We didn't want to use military force. We passed resolutions. We condemned Yugoslavia, as it then was, or Serbia at the UN. We condemned them at the EU. But we couldn't stop it. And so the right to intervene, to interfere, was pulled into being. It was used, again, in Kosovo, because I've been to villages in Kosovo where the villages are jointly part Muslim, part Orthodox Christian, Serb, Muslim, Albanian, Kosovans, part Christian Serb. And you go to the Serb cemeteries, and it's like any cemetery here in Canada or anywhere in the world. You go to the Muslim one, and the people are born on this date in 1920, this date in 1930, this date in 1940, this date in 1950, this date in 1960. But they're all dead on the same day. And that was another genocide in the making. And it required what? It required military intervention to stop it. It was not possible to get the UN to authorize that because China and Russia, only wanting to vote against the United States and France and Britain, refused to allow a UN authorization. So that was an illegal intervention. Was it wrong? I don't know. The alternative would have been another genocide of Muslims on European soil. But we then move on to Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm with Fiore. I mean, I say in the House of Commons, I think the West has broadly, in broad terms, get itself out of Afghanistan. I'm not sure what will follow, and maybe that's a discussion some of you will have with her afterwards. But I do worry again that we become so frightened of our obligation and our right to and our responsibility to protect and intervene that we may be again sitting on our hands when another great genocide takes place and we do nothing about it. Now, I want to go on to a very important point Gordon Engberg mentioned. We have written into the European Constitutional Treaty, a Charter of Fundamental Rights. In broad terms, it's the European Convention of Human Rights, UN, plus some more modern ones. But I took part in debates with the British trade unions about simply the social or trade union rights. And we spent a good couple of days at the Trade Union Congress headquarters. And at the end of our deliberations, I noticed that there were 57 specific, fundamental, universal human rights that the trade unions wanted written into this charter. And I said, guys, ladies, look, you know, are you sure? Because if everything is a human right, then nothing is a human right. And I wonder if at times we confuse demands and desires with fundamental rights. That any new issue that confronts us. And Erwin Kotler is very right to talk about, and the organizer of this conference, the problem of diversity, the problem of religion. I cannot get Tariq Ramadan or the representatives of the Muslim Council of Britain, who are linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, to actually say lapidation should be abolished. It should be outlawed, because they will say it's in the Quran and we cannot go against the teachings of the Holy Prophet, praise be upon his name. But this is a preposterous position. There are horrible things in the Old Testament of the Bible that we've long since outlawed. And I think the worrying problem of the 21st century is the return of religion as a very powerful force, because politics seems so incapable in so many parts of the world of delivering decency and democracy and food and shelter and education and rights for women and rights for men and rights for people from different minorities. So people return to the idea of faith as the exclusive mechanism by which they can define their life. I'm not anti-religious, far from it. But when we have what I call missionary creep, the insistence of religious spokesmen to define the world simply according to something that's handed down from up there and not handed up from the people on this planet, then I think we're reverting to a dangerous world. And my final point is something I just don't quite know how to deal with. I wonder if Stalin and the communist rulers of the Soviet Union and East Europe had made their deal with Walmart in the 1950s, we ever would have heard of Sakharov, and we ever would have had free elections in Poland. But that is the genius, it seems to me, of the rulers of communist China, that they have made their peace with Walmart and with H&M and probably with almost half the garments I'm wearing, so I'm not pretending to be holier than you, my BlackBerry, my mobile phone. And in exchange for giving us all these extraordinarily cheap goods, we have, on our side, given up raising at a significant political, governmental level the problem of between 5 and 10 people in the Logai, in the Chinese forced re-education camps, the thousands of miners who are killed in China, still the imprisonment, the torture of anybody who dares to raise the goalist human rights triptych, saying what they want, going where they want, organizing as they want. And are we, in the name of global capitalism and globalization, simply giving up on human rights because we don't want to challenge our human right to buy a T-shirt for $2 in downtown London or Montreal? I think the relationship between contemporary capitalism and human rights now needs very serious looking at. There are other issues I'd like to talk on perhaps in time. There's a great session on the media tomorrow where I think human rights and Rupert Murdoch need to be rather more seriously discussed than perhaps they are at the moment. Right now the Labour Party is in opposition and we're actually daring to criticise Rupert Murdoch. I just wish perhaps we tried to dare a bit harder when we were in power. But those were former times, as you say, Erwin. Thank you very much.
Speaking of human rights in the interests of the economies of trade, and referring to China, as we meet, there is a letter being organized in the British Parliament and the American Congress and the Canadian Parliament with regard to seeking and securing the release of one of China's referred to as the conscience of China, Gao Dishang, one of the great human rights figures who regrettably was arrested, tortured, disappeared, and at this point has become the object of parliamentary advocacy in three countries on the road to the G20. Our next speaker is Commissioner Faith Panzi-Tlakula from South Africa. She is the chief electoral officer for the South African Electoral Commission. She was a former member of the South African Human Rights Commission. Since 2005, she has been a member of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, where she holds the portfolio with respect to freedom of expression and access to information in Africa. And most importantly, she has played a leading role in seeking to work towards and bring about a post-apartheid, democratic, rights-protecting South Africa.
Good evening. It's an absolute delight to be here. And let me thank the organizers and the sponsors of this conference for inviting me here. I had written a few notes, and I thought I was going to talk to those notes. But having listened to all the speakers, I want to tell you a story. I've had a privilege of being involved at a practical level on the issue of human rights and diverse societies. After we defeated apartheid, as you all know, we came up with a constitution that entrenches almost every conceivable right that you can think of. It entrenches, among others, the right to practice one's religion, to practice one's culture, to speak your language, provided that in doing so, you respect all other rights that are in the Constitution. I then became very privileged to be appointed as a member of the South African Human Rights Commission, and I was one of the first members of that commission. And we took an oath of office in which we promised South Africans that we will execute our function and duties independently, impartially, without fear, favor, or prejudice. Armed with that, one day I receive a call from a young man who tells me the following story. That his mother lives in a village, and at that village, all the people who live there belong to one ethnic group. That his mother is a member of the Jehovah's Witness. That his father died, and in terms of the tradition, the culture that is practiced at that particular village, when a woman loses, or if a husband dies, then a woman has to observe certain mourning rituals. And these rituals are defined in that particular village. The chief of the village expected, and everybody else expected, this woman to observe those mourning rituals after the death of her husband. She then said to the chief, "I cannot observe those mourning rituals because I am a member of the Jehovah's Witness. And in terms of my religion, I cannot do any of the things that are expected of me as a person who lives in this community." There was an uproar in that community. The people in the village says, "You are one of us, you live here, you are supposed to observe our traditions and rituals if you don't please leave our village. That's when our intervention was then sought as members of the Human Rights Commission. I went to the village, convened a meeting with the chief and everybody else there, together with this woman, to try and find an amicable solution to this problem. To say we have a constitution that accommodates everybody. So this woman can live here as a member of the Jehovah's Witness, but she is not forced to practice the culture in this particular village. The members of that ethnic group in that village would not have any of that. They said she either practices our rituals or she leaves the village. Now, what do I do? As the Human Rights Commission, your instinct is, what do you do? You go to court to get an interdict because the tribe wanted her out. So we get an interdict to say that she should not be expelled from the village and that the chief must call all the people to a meeting and explain to them that we live in a constitutional dispensation which accommodates everybody. I do that. After that, I'm feeling very pleased with myself that I've been able to solve this problem. I get into my car and drive back to Johannesburg. This poor woman has to face the tribe and alone. And one of the journalists called me and said, do you think you have solved the problem? You have endangered the life of this poor woman. The matter is all over the newspapers. And that is where the right to practice one's religion came into complete clash with the right of a group to practice their culture. We thought that the matter would go to court, but eventually we settled it out of court. But the crux of the issue as to how do we balance these rights was never decided because the matter was settled amicably. I'm going to tell you another second story, which is even more painful than this. A young woman, not even a woman, a girl of 13 years was married off by her father in one of the villages. And they bundled this poor child, took her against her will to her husband. Her husband obviously treated her as a wife, raped her, and the poor child was in a state of disarray. I received a phone call from a medical doctor who examined this child to say, we have a child here who is a nervous wreck. He's married to, you know, she was married off by her father, and so forth and so on. Can you intervene? And of course, the legal kind of way, we go to the child protection unit. We then take this child away from this man. We take the child to a place of safety. But we feel that, no, we can't just let this thing end here because this child is a minor, 13-year-old. We go to the village where she comes from, and we talk to the chief and says, and to the parents, and we say we cannot leave this matter alone. We then go on and open a case of abduction, a case of rape, a case of kidnapping against one, the husband, and against the father to this child. Because it's the father who gave the child off in this illegal marriage. There was a criminal case. The father and the husband were successfully prosecuted, and they were given an imprisonment sentence. And we were pleased with ourselves that we've been able to solve the problem. But you know what we did? This child, we removed her. That relationship between the child and the parents, that was the end of it until today. That child could not go home, and he came from a rural area many, many, many kilometers out of Johannesburg. She lived in that place of safety. I followed her a few years to know where she, how she was doing until I gave up. As I am talking to you, I don't know what happened to that child and her relationship with her parents. Fast forward, I'm now appointed as a member of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. And I come with this experience of being able to push, you know, for the observance, promotion, and protection of human rights without fear, favor, or prejudice. And I come with that mentality coming from South Africa with a constitution that protects all the rights, including non-discrimination on all sorts of grounds, including sexual orientation. Then we receive an application as members of the commission from a group, from an NGO. You know, NGOs can apply for observer status with the African Commission, like it happens in the UN system. And this application came from an organization which called itself Coalition of African Lesbians. On paper, the application complied with all the requirements, because all that you have to prove to the commission is that your organization has legal existence, that it is established to promote and protect the rights in the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, and the applicants had done a good job in trying to convince us members of the commission that they comply with our requirements for observer status. And I took the application, and that's the mistake that I did. I moved the application, because you have to move the application in an open session in front of everybody else. And I read, I say, I think that this application complies with all our requirements for observer status, and I therefore move that this commission should grant the Coalition of African Lesbians observer status. One of my colleagues said, on what basis are you saying that? Are the LGBTI rights, rights that are protected in the African Charter on Human and People's Rights? I said, yes, of course they are, even if not by name, because the African Charter talks about non-discrimination, says everyone shall have the right to enjoy all the rights in this charter without any distinction on the basis of race, sex, and so on. The charter also talks about the right to respect human dignity. It talks about equality, equal protection of the law. If you look at all these rights that are in the charter, from them one can deduce that the right to sexual orientation is also protected in the charter by purposeful interpretation of the charter. One of my colleagues says, yes, we hear you, but you see there is a section in the charter that you have not addressed that says the state has a duty to protect the morals and traditions that the community recognizes. And therefore, that section claws back on all these rights that you are talking about. And therefore, we cannot grant this organization observer status. I tried very hard, extremely hard, to push, and I failed, because most of my colleagues said sexual orientation goes against the rights that are protected in the African Charter. What I have learned from this experience, that working in some parts of the African continent, the context is always brought in when rights have to be fearlessly protected and promoted. And this is what we have to guard against, because human rights are universal. There is a tendency on the African continent that says every time there is a right that has to be protected, the context is invoked. whether we are talking about indigenous people, in which case people will say, in Africa, all of us are indigenous. Whether you are talking about freedom of expression and access to information, then the issue of the context is brought up to say the foreign media comes here and reports recklessly without understanding the context. And that is a challenge that we are facing in Africa. I am not saying we should not take into consideration the context when we deal with human rights, but we should not use that context to undermine, to violate, and to infringe on the rights of others. Those are my stories. I thank you for your audience.
Just been advised that the discussion that will be taking place will actually not be the discussion amongst the audience, but discussion amongst the panelists. Is that for technical reasons, Francois? Or, I mean, okay. Okay. All right. Well, now I invite Marie Wilson to join us. Our last panelist, Marie, is a member of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That was one of my last acts of our government, was to move to establish this Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She's been a broadcaster with the CBC, regional national reporter, for 25 years. She's received a Distinguished Lifetime Award for her work in broadcasting. Comes with to us also from the Northwest Territories and Nunavut, and I'm delighted to introduce Marie Wilson to you. Marie.
Segon. Bonjour, and good evening, everyone. And let us begin by giving thanks, Niue Sinemasi, for this day and for the Creator bringing us all safely to it. And let us also give thanks to the Mohawk people who are the traditional stewards of this land where we gather today. I'm here to address the question from a personal point of view, which is what I've been invited to do. And as with the other speakers, once you hear all the other speakers, it prompts you to think of several other things that you would like to add. But let me try to quickly go through, from a personal perspective, what I think about the issue of human rights and how it relates to my current job as commissioner, one of the three commissioners, with Canada's Indian Residential School Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And let me just give you some sort of bullet headlines of what I've been thinking about, and then I'll share some thoughts that I hope will flesh out my thinking. The first thing from a personal reflection that I would say is that I think Canadians in general, and I am making generalizations here, tend to think that human rights is an issue about other countries and that it's especially about developing countries and that it's not about us. And reference was made earlier to the protective bubble that applies to many parts of Canada. And I think that's something that is really about our blind spot that we have. I think related to that, I would say that I don't think we know each other very well. And I don't think we know ourselves that well, including our own history, and knowing what the highest laws of our land say about who we are. I think that we allow ourselves to remain limited by our own stereotypes and our icons of ourselves. I think that I've got my page mixed up. Yes, I think that
I think that we have in the field of human rights a great opportunity to shore up a number of disconnects between what we say and what we declare and what we live, both in how we live out our declarations and how we live out our laws, both nationally and internationally. I think that we have before us a tremendous opportunity if we can change our perspective on how we see things. If we can see things that we tend to classify as problems, rather as tremendous opportunities, both for our nation and for our place in the world. And so let me just tell you that these thoughts are really informed by my professional life and my work, which has been a very, very privileged life experience. I grew up in a small town in southwestern Ontario. I lived a very close-to-home life until I was in my late teens. And out of probably the hunger of poverty, was dying to know and discover the rest of the world. And all the details don't matter, but by putting one foot in front of the other, educationally and professionally, I was able to travel and work for long periods of time and shorter periods of time in France, in West Africa, in South Africa, in Germany, in Ireland, in Colombia, in Brazil, and several times in South Africa. I was there training at the South African Broadcasting Corporation during the setup years to the first national elections there, and during the transformation years of the South African Broadcasting Corporation from a state broadcaster to a public broadcaster. And most importantly, at home here in Canada, I've had the tremendous privilege to be up front and close on some of the most important, I think, geopolitical changes in our country over the past 30 years, including the patriation of our Constitution, the inclusion of Aboriginal rights in our Constitution, the signing of massive Aboriginal comprehensive land claims agreements that transformed Aboriginal communities from being organizations that worked out of shopping bags and file folders in briefcases to multi-million dollar corporations with serious interests across Canada and around the world. To see the transformation in that 30 years from having one or two Aboriginal lawyers to having now almost 2,000, two of whom are my fellow commissioners, to having one Aboriginal judge to now having almost 30. And there are many other things. Most importantly, to the work that I am talking about and living over the past year, I am married to someone from the Northwest Territories who has been both the president of the Dene Nation and the premier of the territory. But related to my work is also one of approximately 150,000 former students of Indian residential schools in our country. I've spent the past year listening to so-called survivors of the Indian residential schools in Canada tell me how important it is to have someone sit before them, listen to their story, and tell them, "I believe you." And at the same time, and I should say, tell me that they have waited their entire life to hear someone say that to them. And at the same time, meet with countless gatherings of non-Aboriginal people, very good people, very fine people, say, "I had no idea. I had no idea." So when I say we don't know each other very well, I mean that both in an interpersonal way, and I mean it also in terms of knowing the history of our country as it relates to what we in our highest law of the land say are one of the three founding peoples of our country, the Aboriginal peoples of Canada. We do not know that in our everyday living. There's no evidence of it in the language of public services, in the curriculum in most schools, in the resources provided for school programming. There's no day-to-day evidence of that. What there is instead is frequent example of resistance and begrudgingness rather than seizing the incredible opportunity that I believe Canada has to declare itself proudly a country with three founding nations and to celebrate the rich, rich diversity that comes from the many hundreds of First Nations communities, Inuit communities, and Métis communities across our land, and to go into the world proud of that collective identity. For those of you who don't know, the short story, and this gives a terrible disservice, but the short story of Indian residential schools in Canada is that they existed and started up pre-Confederation, and that the last schools closed in 1996. So you can see it's a very, very long history. It's not a period of war conflict, but it is indeed a period of passive conflict that has had enormous casualties and continues to have enormous casualties. The work of our Truth and Reconciliation Commission takes its mandate from an Indian Residential School Settlement Act. We were not a commission that was set up as a good idea of government. We were set up as an obligation, as part of a complex court-sponsored settlement that resulted from the largest class action lawsuit in Canadian history, brought by former survivors of the schools against the federal government and the four national churches who ran the majority of the schools on contract to the federal government. And if you're interested in the specifics, that's, we're talking about the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, the United Church, and the Presbyterian Church. What is wonderful about our Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and I'm not going to talk about all the elements of the agreement, nor am I a specialist in that, is that unlike most truth commissions, it was designed and agreed to and signed off on by all the parties to the agreement. And if you think about this in the context of a court case, that means the defendants and the plaintiffs agreed to it together. And that in itself is something to acknowledge and to be proud of the courage involved in that. It also is, to our knowledge, the only truth commission in history that focuses very specifically on something that happened to little children. This is not a story about grown-up Aboriginal people. It's about something that happened to little children, some of them as young as 2 and 3 years old. And it is something that happened to children of a specific ethnicity, the First Nations, Inuit, and Métis children. And it happened not illegally, it happened specifically as a result of government laws and policies that were designed to remove the Indian from the child, and to do so by removing them from the heathen influences of their parents. Unlike, and I received a very intelligent question from one of the international scholars yesterday, unlike a normal boarding school, children did not attend these schools by choice nor by the choice of their parents, though it is true that in latter years there were parents who wanted their children to receive an education and sent them. And it is also important to know that over the course of the 140 years or so, the circumstances did change. But for many of those years, the schools were mandatory. Education for those Aboriginal children was mandatory at a time when it was not mandatory for non-Aboriginal children. It was mandatory at a time and over a course of time where all of the normal democratic rights that we would think of exercising today, if you were in your mind's eye and in your heart able to imagine if someone came along and said, I am taking away your 5-year-old, your 6-year-old, your 7-year-old, I'm taking them away, and you have nothing to say about that, what would we do? We would raise a fuss through all the tools at our disposal, I'm sure. First of all, we would say no. No, you could not say no because the laws of the day said if you refused, you as a parent could go to jail. Then we would say, well, then I'm going to get together with my buddies and we're going to protest this. But no, because the laws of the day that were passed denied the right to gather. Then you would say, well, I'm going to hire a good lawyer, best one I can find. I'm going to fight this. No, because the laws that were passed did not allow you to hire a lawyer. And then you would say, well, then I'm going to vote them out of office. But no, because the laws were passed that took away your right to vote, which you did not get back the last ones in Canada until 1960. So in the context of that, little children were taken away sometimes for weeks, depending where the school was, sometimes for months, and in many, many cases for years at a time. And we've spent the past year hearing these stories of children coming home, their parents not recognizing them. And in any case, they couldn't speak to them because their language was taken away. And I could go on and on, but I'm going to offer you, in the words of a survivor, from a book recently published called My Heart Shook Like a Drum. I'm sharing this account because not because it's exceptional, but because it's typical of what we've heard in various phraseology over the past year. I lost my native language for the rest of my life. I became ashamed of who I was and ashamed of being an Indian. I was hurt and humiliated many times without the ability to properly explain myself to anyone. My voice was silent. I could not speak my own language. I was not allowed to, and I could not speak the new language expected of me. My thoughts and feelings were hurt many times, resulting with hatred, which I never exposed, but kept it inside of me, feeling rage, but unable to express it to anyone. The dynamics of abuse were left to the parents and the villages as a whole to take care of, with no strategic planning or proper communications or any idea of what to do about the dysfunctions. All the settlements were ill-equipped to handle English children like me. The language barrier for the kids and parents was just the first of the problems. The long-term impacts are still here today: mental problems, jealousy, possessiveness, emotional turmoil, low self-esteem, violence, corporal punishment, sexual assaults, and the pervasive loss of spirituality. The stigma of everything that happened to us remains in our minds forever, and in many cases is visited upon the next generation. And that is the account of Alice Blondin Perrin in her book. I can tell you that a short version of my own husband's story is that we were married for 15 years before I had any idea that anything had gone wrong in the residential schools he attended. And I say that to you because I think it speaks in part to why we are only now having this awakening as Canada about this story. Because he, like so many others, did not talk about it, could not talk about it. For one thing, it made him physically ill. And I share this with his permission, just so you know that. But also, as he was finally able to articulate it, because as a little child at the time, he believed what he was told, that it was his fault, that he was bad, that he was the only one, that if he told anyone, as he tried to, he would be further punished, and that if he told anyone else, they wouldn't believe him anyway. And so I take you back to my comment, sitting eye to eye, heart to heart, with someone who has been through this story and saying, "I believe you," becomes a very, very important, loaded, simple sentence. And it becomes commitment, a commitment to human rights as expressed in our everyday relationships, our humanity, the humanity behind human rights, not the politics behind human rights. And I think this is our challenge. And this is what I mean when I say I think we have disconnects between what we declare and how we live out our laws and our declarations both nationally and internationally. And as a case in Canada, Canada, for those of you who may not be aware, received from our Prime Minister and from all the national political leaders very profound, I would almost say poetic, but certainly heartfelt apologies about the history of residential school and an acknowledgement that it was wrong, that it did great harm, and that it's caused a legacy that lives on today. And it lives on in our jails, on the streets, in the social services. There are more children in child welfare services in Canada today than there ever were at any single point in the history of residential schools. And if you trace the history of those children, the vast majority who are Indigenous are the children or grandchildren of survivors who raised them in anger, who raised them with limited education, who tried to learn in a context of perpetual trauma, who did not see any modeling of parenting, who had no idea of what it was to have a sibling relationship because siblings were separated and discouraged from being together, much less comforting each other in any of the normal ways we think of in normal, healthy, family-loving situations. And so we live with that legacy, and we live with a history which right now most Canadians think is about Aboriginal people. We have enormous work to do as a society to realize and to register that it is about Canada. It is our shared history. It is our shared past. And even for new Canadians, we don't get to cherry pick which parts of Canadian history we like. We get all of it. And we need to influence the future. And we need to be the model that we talk internationally. We need to earn the proud reputation we wish for ourselves internationally. And we must not keep secrets in our closets. So that when we offer these heartfelt poetic apologies, we have to recognize there is a disconnect in the hearts of those who want to believe that apology when within months we announce an international forum. Thankfully, Canada has no history of colonization. Or when in that same time frame we decline as one of the two countries in the world to sign the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. If we have no history of colonization, if that is true, then why would we resist signing that declaration? And especially given that it's a non-binding declaration anyway. How do we align the disconnects between the fact that in 1959, the UN Declaration on the Rights of the Child were signed off, and at that point, Canadian Aboriginal people as a whole, not just children, still didn't have the right to vote, or that in 1989, when the convention was signed, we still had active residential schools. We've heard passionate comments today about international human rights issues, and they're extremely important. They are what bind us at the level of humanity and our best selves. And in order to have something to offer, I think we need to strengthen that in our own home so that we can be beacons and so that we can be models and we can be our best selves. And I think that we have enormous opportunity to do that, not by trying to fix the situation with Aboriginal people, but by learning humility as a country, by setting aside the arrogance that led to policies that were specifically named to assimilate and Christianize, that we set those aside and with humility say, we wish to know who we are. We wish to have all Canadians know that we have three founding nations, as our Constitution says, and to put some reality into that so that we know what it means in our priorities and in our service to each other. Because what is the point of our relationships as a nation, as families or as nations, if it's not to bring out our best in each other? I can tell you absolutely from a personal perspective that you are far more likely to die if you are an Indigenous person in Canada from lack of health services, whether that's access to medical or access to clean water, then or presence of tuberculosis or suicide, where we are at the top of the list internationally in Indigenous communities in Canada, than you are through any risk of airport travel. And so we need to think about how do we live out our human rights every day in our relationships, both interpersonally and in our relationships between and among peoples. I think it's a wonderful opportunity. I want so much to thank Rowan Cotler for the list of the seven R's. I thought he was going to list through the seven sacred teachings that indigenous people talk about, and respect being right up there on the list. But what I think is useful by his list is that reconciliation is way down there. And our job is to, as a commission, is to learn the whole truth about the residential school history, to teach it and make it known to all of Canada as best we can, to safeguard it so that we can never again hide behind our own ignorance, to establish a national research center where it will be protected and accessible for future academics and future citizens, and to commemorate it in ways that are not begrudging, but that are honoring, and that show our courage and that show our highest qualities as a country. I think there's tremendous opportunity in this, but the important thing to make it happen is that we know we are all in this together. We are not, this is not an Indigenous issue, this is a Canadian issue. And the rest of the country, and especially those many countries, now over 60, that have had truth commissions of their own, are looking to Canada with great interest and with great hope that we can show new lessons to the world on how to do this in a good way. So I thank you for hearing my comments, and I thank you going forward for all that I hope you will be able to contribute to this important work that binds us all. Merci chou.
I was told by Francois that we have to vacate the room by 7:15. So what I'm going to do is perhaps put one or two questions that the panelists can perhaps address them, and take one generic one on the matter of human rights, diversity, on the issue of migration. The United Nations recently estimated that at this point there are some 214 million migrants across the globe. In other words, an increase of about 37% in the last two decades. This is an increase of 41% in Europe and 80% in North America. And as a Professor Freeman, political scientist, put it, there is at this point more mobility than at any time in world history, to which Daniel Myers, who's at University of Southern California, a demographer, said, and I quote, "When you get increased diversity, you weaken support for the common good." And my question is, the migration is a reality. Diversity, and dramatically increasing diversity, is a reality. Are we eroding support for the common good, or are we enriching the common good? Those who wish to reply, I invite you to do so, because, Dennis?
Well, yeah, I think there is a very real tension. Firstly, I dislike intensely the word immigrant. I prefer, and I'm speaking now from a European context, my own country, the district or constituency or riding where I'm the MP, I prefer the term semigrant, in the sense that the immigrant of old left to find a new life, had some connections to where he or she came from, but the next generation, in broad terms, joined the common wheel or wherever they came to. We're not talking about the horrible experiences you're describing and the Magdalene sisters in Ireland and what happened in Australia mirrors that. But the umbilical cord was broken, and then you became British or French or American. Well, now it doesn't happen that way. You know, people live two or three, I mean, people who move only emigrate. Because if I go into my Muslim Kashmiri friends' homes in South Yorkshire, they're not watching the BBC or British television, they're watching PTV, GTV, those two Pakistan channels. They are reading, I read every morning, the Dawn, the Nation, the Jang, the Pakistan newspapers, which are now printed and in an English edition on sale. Their kids have been taken out of school for 3 or 4 months at a time to go back to Kashmir. And so there are, I think, then problems of immigration. And the rights they want to uphold, where you draw the line between an arranged marriage and a forced marriage, I'm not sure. I've got many distressing constituency cases of women who come to me with problems, but when I talk to community leaders, they say, well, that was an arranged marriage. The cousin marriage, very compelling in that community, but the incidence then of genetic disorder is extraordinarily high. And their children, the privilege of marrying your cousin is, you stand twice as much chance of giving the children then certain genetic problems the rest of their lives. And it's, I mean, all these are the most sympathetic medical investigations. And we're finding that generally. And we have a million Poles have come into Britain in 5 years. Now, my father was Polish. It's not a problem for me. They're filling up the Catholic churches. But suddenly, if they are taking scarce social housing, and if a company that was employing 10 carpenters, paying them £14 an hour, say $20 Canadian an hour, gets rid of those 10 carpenters and replaces them with 10 highly qualified Poles, but only paying them £8 an hour, then you've got a social problem. And the Poles aren't coming to emigrate, but they're called immigrants. And so we bundle together, this is in the European experience, the British experience, all sorts of people who aren't the classic immigrant, which is to say why I prefer this term semigrant, because communication, television, the internet, the sending back of remittances, the bringing over, not just for one generation, but for a second generation or a third generation or a fourth generation, poor people from the country from whence you came, basically to bring a relative into a much wealthier society. So there's very little marrying out, to use, if I may, a Jewish expression. And that, I just worry about that. And it's very hard then, when certain rights are defending. I mean, yeah, I've even had articulate defense of female genital mutilation. I've had defense of sex trafficking as a force of liberation, of prostituted women, who I think are a very oppressed group of people. But they'll have their advocates say, oh, no, they're just happy hookers. I mean, you know, 10, 15 penises a day, yeah, that's no problem. They're sex workers. Give them rights. I mean, that's certainly what their pimps and traffickers want to have them translated as. So I think diversity and core human rights, there can be a genuine political and policy conflict that has to be worked through. I don't have any easy answers. But I do worry that contemporary immigration now is posing very real challenges which we have difficulty in absorbing, particularly when the economic downturn means that, because this is always a fight between the poor and the poor immigrants and the poor working class. And we've seen it with Irish people in Britain. They were treated in a horrible way until very recently. We've seen it with Afro-Caribbean people. They were treated horribly. See it continuously still with Pakistani Kashmiri people. See it now with huge numbers of asylum seekers. And again, there, I think there are real problems. The notion of the refugee is somebody fleeing intolerable persecution. Well, I have many people live in my constituency who came from some Kosovo or northern Iraq, the Kurdish areas, which now do not face any prosecution, but they don't wish to return home. I understand that, and I have sympathy with it. But again, other people are saying, but he gets or she gets that house, that right, that family benefit, their children straight into the school, and they don't even teach them English at home, and therefore my child's education is held back slightly. And these are real social tensions which in Europe have given rise to every country a massive increase in extremist identity politics. I mean, the Jobbik party in Hungary, openly anti-Semitic. Sweden, social democratic Sweden, just elected 20 MPs from the Swedish Democratic Party. Usually when you hear democratic in now in a party's title in Europe, it means anti-immigrant or anti-Muslim. The Swiss, peaceful, rich Switzerland, just voting in a referendum to ban the building of any mosque with minarets. 15% of the French voters consistently voting anti-Semitic, fascist, National Front. The Northern League in Italy, no more Muslims. Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and the Conservatives and Liberals there forming a government, not with him in coalition, but with him supporting them because they need his 50% of his seats in the parliament to form a government. And he is saying, nobody into the Netherlands who doesn't speak Dutch, no support for minority Islam people, a complete ban on burqas, and I'm not sure whether it's going to niqabs and hijabs. So this is what we're facing in Europe, maybe not in Canada, that when people don't feel that their sense of their own rights has some broad acceptance, then they say, right, we'll turn to the parties that will speak up for us, and it's very frightening.
Thank you, Dennis. I note that we have reached the time when we apparently are required to adjourn. I just want to maybe not ask these questions be answered, but just to put some questions that I think might be in our minds that we might want to discuss. Ms. Joya made the point, and an important point, about the need for education being emancipation, and also speaking about why it was important for the NATO forces to leave Afghanistan. Question I would put, and I regret that we don't have time to have it responded to, is there a role for NATO forces, not in any military sense, but in order to help protect and promote education on the road to emancipation? In other words, is there a development role in Afghanistan, and not a military role? I would mention to Pansy the question you mentioned about human rights being universal human rights should not be diminished by context. The question is, can context perhaps, in another way, enrich human rights? In other words, you talked about law in the books and law in action. Sometimes law in action may diminish law in the books, but maybe is the reverse also possible. Marie, I think you left us with an important lesson that we have to live human rights, and that the indigenous issue is really not an issue for indigenous people only, but an issue for Canadians as a whole. And I think perhaps we can take leave of this panel and this first plenary session by saying that human rights is an issue for all of us. And at the end of the day, the future of human rights is what we do with the promotion and protection of human rights in the present. Thank you all for your attention and your involvement.
I'd like to thank Erwin for chairing this panel. I would like to thank the panelists for the inspiration they've given us. I think we had people from four continents on stage giving us stories from their personal backgrounds, moving stories. And we are going to take these stories into the panels tomorrow and try to use them as context for all the discussions we're going to have. To close the evening, we have a musical performance, and I will ask the musicians, I can't see anything, but I'd like to ask the musicians to come on stage and join us. I don't see any movement. Here they are. Yeah. Maybe, yes. Yes, that might be. You'll see better from over there. I'd like to introduce Mr. Hassan Abdul Hai. He is a Montrealer, originally from Syria, and he's an oud player. He will be accompanied by Jenny Grout. Jenny Grout will be singing. She is a student at the McGill Faculty of Music.
Thank you. Stage. So I'll see you tomorrow. Have a good evening.